I was on the treadmill yesterday, and I was watching Cupcake Wars, and they quoted Yoda in Star Wars, which is actually, I've never seen that movie, but they quoted him as saying, do or do not, there is no try. Okay. I thought, oh, I like that. That's nice. And then I started thinking about how really I think in life, in the end, because I'm now at the point where I don't believe in therapy anymore. I've gotten to this stage in life where I think if I go into therapy to talk about a problem, I'll be in a nursing home by the time I've solved it. You know, so I'm like someone who like believes in getting a blow dry for my hair instead of going to the therapist because it makes me feel so good. But this is, and one other thing I want to say, which is that this is the first time I've spoken in public, actually, since my sister died in June, and several people have mentioned Nora to me, and I just want to say that I appreciate so much how much everyone loved her, and really, she is the embodiment of do not, there is no try. If you had to pick someone to embody that, that was my sister, because nothing ever stopped her. So I guess we should dedicate it not to Yoda, but to Nora. But I'm just going to tell you a lot about the path I took and why I took it and what made me make changes and why I made them and something about the book I wrote, which is about women who are stuck in a place and can't get through it. And then I'll leave a lot of time for questions. I grew up in Beverly Hills. My parents were screenwriters, and my mother was a working mother when nobody else in town or anyone we knew was a working mother. She was a screenwriter, and she had grown up in this very, very poor family in the Bronx, and they didn't believe in educating the women. They only believed in educating the men, and she had gone to Hunter, which is a public college, and the boys had gone to private colleges, and she was really angry about that. And she raised daughters, and all she told us again and again and again was that we had to have a career, and actually, in truth, we had to be writers. She didn't say that, but you know how the unspoken messages are as powerful as the spoken messages. And that was, and she was very, very tough. She had a million theories about life. She had one I've never understood. One was never buy on sale. I have no idea why she said that. She said, don't worship celebrities. They're no better than you are, which I always thought was a great one. And she said, just because you're related to someone is no reason to love them. Now, I actually think that's one of the most liberating things anyone can tell you. And the fact that your mother is giving you permission to hate her is quite awesome, right? But if you're a writer, you have to be able to imagine feelings for everybody in the world that you're creating. And if you're in life and someone tells you when you're feeling something that's not the right thing to feel or it's not appropriate or anything, you know, that is just, you feel it, and that's the most important thing about the feeling. So I felt that that was probably the greatest thing she told me and has stood me well in my life of trying to raise stepchildren, I will tell you that. Anyway, she picked all our classes for us. I mean, we were very headstrong women, and she told us everything we had to do. We had to take 2 years of Latin and 3 years of French, and you had to take Latin because you had to understand language, its origins. I did never understood anything about language and its origins from my Latin class, but she really had ideas, and she obviously had the imagination to create not only her own life, but a life for her daughters. So, and the dinner table was hugely important in our family. We all sat around the table, we played 20 questions, we played charades, we had to tell stories, and if I ever said anything funny, my dad would yell, "That's a great line, write it down." So, or that's a great title. So I had all these titles by the time I was 12 for no books, you know. But it was good because it gave me the idea that things I said were actually useful in more than just evaporate at the dinner table, that it was actually worth writing down. So my sister, Nora, went off and became a writer immediately. And I, of course, being the second child, did not. I mean, all that pressure was just too much for me. So I got married to the first person who asked me. And I moved to Rhode Island, and I was like, he was a professor at Brown, and I was, I didn't have anything to do, actually, which my mother was very worried about. And I got a job as this thing called a Girl Friday, which is what you called women with college degrees who were secretaries, basically, I guess. And I worked for this really, really mean boss in this architecture firm. And he wasn't really mean to me. And this was like my first life lesson, which is that somebody, a mean boss, is eventually going to be mean to everyone, you know? So after about 6 months there, he just started picking on me the way he was picking on other women, I should say. And I said to him, I quit. And as I walked out the door, he yelled, you're flat-chested. Okay? So, all right? So, listen, your humiliations always become your best stories. I just want to say that. So, so now, like, I'm unemployed in Rhode Island and flat-chested, which is not that going to get me, you know? So, I don't know. I had no idea what to do with myself. So I went into the crocheting business. And I decided that I had a girlfriend who was a little more talented than me at this. And she taught me how to crochet. And we began crocheting purses and belts for New York department stores. Someone actually took an order for like 150. And I swear, I was crocheting day in and day out. 100 hours a day. It was that sort of unreal. And I went to New York for the weekend, and I was at a party, and there was an editor from Simon & Schuster there, and it was a guy, actually, and I walked up to him, and I said, I know you'd never be interested in this. I mean, do you believe that? I would say it like that, but anyway, I know you would never be interested in this, but would you like to publish a book on crocheting? And he said, yes. I don't know why he did. Well, it certainly wasn't the way I presented myself, which was unspeakable, and don't ever do it. I guess I didn't want to admit I was a writer, but I somewhere it was working its way into my consciousness. You know, I think the thing about being in your 20s is that you just, well, I didn't. I can only speak for myself. I didn't really understand that I had one life and that it was finite and that eventually I needed to become something. And by the time I got to 30, I suddenly thought, oh, this is it. This is my life. You know, and what am I doing with it? It was this unbelievably powerful thing when I was about 28 or 29 that it began to set in that I just couldn't be floating around like this. And I wrote a little proposal for this book, and he bought it. And I had this book to write, which was all about how to make purses and belts and sweaters and everything. So I wrote this book, and when I was doing it, I began to admit to myself that I wanted to be a writer. And so I told my husband, I have to say my first husband, that I wanted to be a writer, and he said, I don't want you to be a writer. And I said, why? And he said, I don't want you to become famous. Suppose you become famous. So I said, I promise I won't be famous. So obviously I had to leave him, right? But the thing about this is, and I did leave him, I'm making a joke, but I will. And it seems so obvious to me in retrospect. Of course, I had to leave him. At the time, it was so terrifying. It was just like burning the bridge you're standing on. I mean, it wasn't the worst marriage in the world by any means. It was stable. He wasn't particularly mean. I mean, there was no place to breathe or fly or be free, really. But it was safe, and safety, it always mattered to me. And so I felt like I was just jumping off a cliff to do this. But I knew I was like, I was running up on against 30 years old, and I knew I just had to make this move. So we had had a house there, and we sold it, and I remember he said to me, you won't have any of this money in 2 years, and I'll still have mine. And he was right, actually. 2 years late, you know, I went to New York, and actually I made a plan. I mean, I just, you know, it was terrible he was upset, and it was an awful thing if anyone here has been divorced, you know, it's just the most disruptive thing. You keep thinking, you know, you get someplace and you think, I'm not where I should be, I should be somewhere else. It's like you're looking for a home that's disappeared on you, and it takes a while to ground yourself again. So I was, you know, but I did have a plan, and my plan was that I would figure out where in New York I needed to get published in order to have a career. I figured out that, okay, women's magazines were not going to jump my career. I had to get into the New York Times. So my plan was to use my money and somehow network and write and eventually get myself there. And I did. In 2 years, I had a piece pub. Just before, I was down to my last $200, and it would have been seven if I hadn't fallen in love with an orange coat. But, you know, a girl has to look good. So I was down, and I sold this piece to the New York Times, and my fantasies, really, I was just blessed. It was an incredible success, this little piece. It was 500 words about children and food. It was called How to Eat Like a Child. It was all about how I eat chocolate pudding. And it struck a chord, and I got offered a book contract, and I was officially a writer. So, you know, these things that you do in life, and then you look back, and then you just say, oh, of course that was going to happen, of course that was, but none of it was of course. I really did. It always takes this incredible amount of guts and nerve to believe in yourself. And I always find that kind of thing where you think, this isn't going to work, or I shouldn't have the nerve to do it, it's always dogged me. You know, it's not like, oh, I have that success, and then I think, oh, I'm now confident, I now know what I'm going to do. I mean, the other week I gave, like, actually the other week, 2 months ago, I gave my book to a producer in New York, a Broadway producer that I had met, and I wanted, because I wanted to develop The Line Is In as a play. And he never called me back. You know that thing when you don't get the call back, you know? And so, of course, you know, I wait about 2 weeks, and then I think, okay, I better call. So I call, and he doesn't return my call. And then I place another call. It's getting harder, by the way, and I don't have a secretary to make the call. You know, I mean, I have to make the call. And I never heard back from him. So the other week, I went to an event, which I didn't even want to go to. You know that thing where you think, I don't want to leave the house? You know, it's so much nicer in my house. Why should I leave the house? But, you know, it's always good to leave the house. If you take nothing away from this except that, remember how good it is to leave the house. And I was somewhere, and he was there, and he said, oh, my God, I'm so embarrassed. I lost your book. And I finally found it last week, and I'm reading it. And I thought, oh, you see, you just went negative on yourself. You know, you just went to that place. And, you know, it's really important, I think, not to do that. And I don't think you should ever look at someone who, like, it looks from the outside how easy it is. I mean, all my women friends who write or who do this, or all the men too, I mean, we've all, you know, have these moments where we just go negative on ourselves. And someone told me that worrying is negative goal setting, which I think is such a great thing. But, of course, that didn't stop me from doing it. But I do think that's true. I just want to say that there's some of these, I now have all these little tricks I do to stop me from being negative. And they're so ridiculous that I'm going to tell you about them. One is I'm wearing boots. And one reason I'm wearing boots is that my sister and I wrote this play, Love, Loss, and What I Wore, which is a story of women told through the clothes they wear, because after all, whenever we want to reinvent ourselves, the first place we go is the store and, you know, change what we look like, or we go to the store and we buy something and we get home and we think, who is this person? I don't even recognize myself in these clothes. But, you know, clothes tell a story, and we asked all our girlfriends to write us stories about their lives, and all the stories about boots poured in. Boots just matter to women. They make you feel stronger, confident, hotter, taller. They're really important, and I didn't realize it. I felt very stupid about that. So now I always wear boots. I'm wearing them today. I'm 2 inches taller because of it. And the other, I have mentioned hair blowouts, but I believe that whenever you're going somewhere, look fantastic. I'm totally into the fact that I think women need to learn to public speak, and if your children don't and they're shy, you know, find a way to get your daughters to learn to present themselves, because even if they never have to stand in front of a microphone, they're going to have to go into a meeting, they may have to pitch themselves, sell themselves. You know, I'm just fanatic now because I've given out awards at film schools where the girls are so shy and they stand behind the guys and the guys are kind of cool, and I just want to start screaming. You know, I get so upset by it, and I think we're just not teaching our daughters or ourselves to present ourselves. And so even if I have something really important, I'll stop by a makeup counter at a department store and just buy a lipstick so they'll make up my face. And then I go and I feel that much better. I mean, I do these like weird little tricks. The other thing I do is I channel my girlfriends. Like, I have this friend, I had to go on a book tour this year for The Lion Is In, and I just really don't like to fly. I mean, I'm not someone that just, you know, gets to an airport and think, whoa, an adventure, you know? I just really don't. So I just, my friend Jill has climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and she's trekked through countries that I never even heard of and slept in trees. So I just decided that I would be Jill, and I would go and be open, and I would make eye contact with seatmates and all sorts of things like that, you know? And I got on a plane to Nashville in Jill mode. And the next thing I know, I was talking to this woman who was so charming, who ran a cancer charity in Nashville, and she said, oh my God, you have to come to this event tonight. You know, Lydia is doing the food, and there are all these country western stars. I don't know anything about country western, but sounded, you know. But I was Jill. So I said, yes, I would love to come, you know. So then I got off the plane, I got to my hotel room, and all I wanted to do was like order up a Law and Order marathon on television and go to bed, you know, but I said no. So I called Jill and I said, now am I supposed to go to this thing? And she said, yes, and you stay 15 minutes, and if it's terrible, you leave, but it wasn't. It was absolutely great, and I made all these friends, I met all these great women, and I sat at the same table with this guy who wrote Dock of the Bay. And he didn't speak to me, but it was still great, and the food was great. And I had this adventure because I was Jill, you know. And I have another friend who's just always sees the most positive side of everything. I'm sort of riveted by her. I wish I knew her mother or something, but she's English, so I think she's just in denial all the time, you know what I mean? I think she's someone that just doesn't know what she feels at all, so she always thinks she feels good, but nevertheless, sometimes I'm just thinking, you know, okay, I'm looking on the negative side. Julia would not be looking on the negative side. And, you know, we have our girlfriends for good reason. You know, we have them because they look at the world differently. They change the way we see things. They make us braver. I mean, if you have a girlfriend who's making you feel worse, I suggest you get rid of her. But mostly now I have girlfriends who really are, you know, enrich my life. And I've now decided that I'm just going to become them when I need to. And it's just a little, you know, all these tricks work, oddly enough. They absolutely work. So anyway, that's important. That's really important. When I got to New York, I have to say about sisterhood, when I moved to New York and I had no money and everything, Nora was waiting for me with open arms, and I know that made a big difference in my ability to come to New York, but I needed an apartment, and she took me all around, and she, you know, finally we found this great apartment, and, excuse me, I have allergies, and the only thing was the guy promised it to someone else. So Nora said, well, you don't want him, you know, you want my sister, you don't want him. She said, you know, she found out the guy had a dog, and she said, you don't want a dog in this apartment, it's way too nice for a dog. And he said, yeah, but I don't have a lease. And she said, oh, I can get a lease. He said, well, who will type it up? She said, I'll type it up. So she drags him off to the stationery store. You know, I'm in shock. You know, I'm getting divorced, so I can't even put one foot in front of the other. But she's like, she takes us to the stationery store. She gets it. She takes him back to her office. She sticks the lease in the typewriter. She types it up for him. And he asks to use the phone. And he calls someone and says, I've been kidnapped. You know. So I have had always the sisterhood of, you know, not just girlfriends, but of course my sisters, and we've always been really supportive of each other. Not actually, I don't know why I said that. You know, sisters are complicated, and we all know that there is a big difference between a sister and a girlfriend. You know, and sometimes you pick your girlfriends because they aren't like your sisters. You know, because they're able to. I mean, it's the most complicated thing, because I always think that in losing my sister, I've actually lost an arm. You know, and that's different from losing a friend. It's just a different kind of feeling. And so, you know, I do think that, but I grew up a sister. I was born a sister, and sisterhood is really important in my life. And when I was writing, this book is that I've written, The Lion Is In, is about a sisterhood of three women, and in ways they relate like sisters, in ways they relate in some ways a healthier, more friend-like way. But it is the sisterhood that gets them through and the love of a lion named Marcel. And I wrote this book because I had so much anxiety going on in my life. So many things were just difficult. And it was about 3 years ago. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm just going to be anxious all day. I can really worry something a lot. And I thought, how am I going to not be worried and not be taking Valium or something, right? Which doesn't really work for me, okay, because of the grogginess and all, and the possibility that you just might get addicted for life. But anyway, so I went to sleep, and I had this really amazing dream about three women. They were in a roadhouse bar. It was the clearest dream I've ever had in my life. It was a story. It was so obvious. In this crazy roadhouse bar, built of materials that kind of hammered every which way, there were two 20-year-old women whose names I knew, Lana and Tracy. Tracy was in a wedding dress. Rita was there, but I didn't know her name. She was 50, and she was timid. And there was a lion in a cage. And I knew they were on the run. And I knew that the lion was going to change their lives. And I also knew that the wedding veil on Tracy was going to end up on the lion's head, and I don't know why I knew that, but I knew that too. And I woke up, and I thought, oh my God, I've just dreamed myself my next novel. And I realized that what writers can do, and I don't know if anyone here is are there any peer who are aspiring writers? Is anybody, am I talking to? Oh, okay, so I do. One of the great things about it is that you can create an alternate universe to live in that makes you really happy. And while I was writing this book, I was not feeling domestic. This is an adventure story, and I wasn't feeling in a domestic mood. And so I was able to put myself on the road with these women and in this bar, and in North Carolina, by the way, a state I'd never been in. I don't know why my dream took place there. But the three characters, because it came from my subconscious, are completely rooted in the issues of my life. Lana, who is the 26-year-old more alpha girlfriend, is struggling to be sober. And both my parents were alcoholics. And I grew up, I sort of started when I was around 11. So I had this very lovely childhood, and then it just turned. I don't know if any of you have had that, where you sort of have this, the before and the after is so different. So that's always been a very powerful thing to me, addiction, and with Lana, she's sober, but she still, unfortunately, has the need for trouble. She still is full of anger. She still has shame. She still has guilt. And if you have either kids or you know how being sober is just this getting sober is just this much of it. The rest of it is the really hard work. So Lana is on the road with this need for trouble, and Tracy, her best friend, who is a kleptomaniac, has the law actually after her. But her need is love. And I think, because I grew up in this family where my mother talked about work all the time but never mentioned love, that was the surprise of my life, was that I met someone I fell in love with. And I really do think, that I had a dog and I fell in love with my dog, and I had stepchildren and I fell in love with them too. It took longer, but I did. But the great thing was I had the dog, because, you know, if you have stepchildren, you need someone in the house that loves you. So a dog was very important. But all these different ways that I was able to find love seem really miraculous to me. And so Tracy trying to shed the law and find love is her issue. And then Rita's 50, and she's been in what I consider just a soul-crushing marriage, because, like my first marriage, there was no way for her to use her imagination or breathe or fly or be, you know, free. And so she has walked out on a minister wife of 30 years and is on the road when they pick her up. And what happens in this book, which is about a lion who needs salvation too, is that the lion becomes almost, in many ways, lover, friend, shrink, higher power, all sorts of important things. But it is really the sisterhood that they form also that gets them through. But I think that the important thing about this book, the most important thing, is that in our lives, in order to change, we have to get in the cage with the lion. You have to figure out what that means to you. You have to get in the cage with the lion, and which Rita does, and you need to roar. And those things, I think I wrote the book because of my own needs in this way, and my needs to take, you know, being stuck, and which all these three women are, and move them forward. And I was very stuck. I was very anxious, and I just had to move myself forward. And so the book, in a very funny, playful, but a very emotional way, just takes you on that journey through women's relationships, three women's friendships. Anyway, I would love to answer any questions you have. I've skipped over my life in movies. I'm happy to answer any questions about that or anything else that you might want to know. Yes. Yes, I had. I had written How to Eat Like a Child was a bestseller, so right away I had a profile. And then I wrote a book called Teenage Romance, and it was a very funny book. And at that time, you know, we now accept how funny women are. There are so many women comedians out there. I mean, just they're all over the place, like Amy Poehler, and, you know, they're just great. But then there weren't a lot of funny women, and I was funny. So I got asked if I wanted to write, you know, a screenplay of this book, and I said yes. And then my husband's a screenwriter, and he basically taught me how to do it. I would come home with these awful pages, and he would say, you know, where's the drama? Where's the conflict? I mean, he really taught it to me. And then, of course, Nora then decided to be a director, and she didn't want to do that alone. It's so scary to bite off directing, and she thought if we wrote together, she would just have me, and she would have someone that she trusted who would always be honest. You know what a scary word that is for a sister. I began to expand in lucky ways through that connection. Yes?
If there was, maybe it's too sensitive, but if there was anything that you didn't like about Nora, what would it be?
Oh, my God, I could not. You know, it's so weird. I think that, first of all, I'm talking about her, but it's difficult for me. I just want to say that, you know. But I don't think I could ever answer that one. I mean, not that I don't have an answer. Because sisters always have answers like that, you know. There's ways, but, you know, now it seems so unimportant. Yes. Yes.
Seems to me that there is a new wave of women that are emerging, the moms who have raised their children, the tail of the baby boomers, and they're starting to redevelop and redefine the future life for themselves. Would you have any advice on how to break away from the pack or differentiate yourself so that you are
Yeah, you know, I think we're all suffering now because the economy is so bad, and I think it's just making harder these moves that we all need to make. I do think women are brilliant at reinventing themselves. I think one of the great things about being a mother or being in one world, there's something about women, the way we're raised or how our brains are wired, we really, really can reinvent ourselves and reimagine ourselves. And so I think part of it is that you, I hate to say it this way, but I really believe that you have the answer. You know what it is that your gifts are. After a certain point in life, you know what your gifts are. You know what your passions are. And you know where you could really excel. And then the question becomes, how do I get there? And is that there still there? And the reason I say that is that journalism now is changing so much. I have a lot of girlfriends who are writers who are 50, 45 and 50, who can't get work as journalists anymore because the world of journalism has changed so much. You know, there's so few newspapers, there's so many fewer magazines, you know, things have shifted online. So, you know, in this culture that's changing, you really have to figure out how your gifts fit into the culture. And I think that that's the hardest job that we, I mean, I'm always feeling technologically at a loss at my age. I'm over 60. So it's, you know, my brain is not wired for certain stuff going on. And I actually hire people to help me do stuff I can't do because I just hate being out of the loop. But I get very frustrated when I hear people say, well, I do Twitter and Facebook. And I love Twitter, actually. I think it's really fun. But I'm always upset when I hear people who are my age say, well, I don't do that. And it's not, because the culture is changing. And I always think it's important to figure out not everything about the culture, but how you can still fit into a culture that's changing. And I always think that your answers, I think women like to be satisfied by their work. I don't think paychecks are just what it's about for women. I think that's just different for them. I do. So you really have to figure out where you fit, what your gifts are. And I always think that if you have a friend who, I mean, I think it can be hard to work with a friend because you have to be equally committed. You have to both be equally passionate about this thing. So sometimes having a friend to team with to do it, if you want to open a business or something, is a great thing. And sometimes it's just what you're doing because you don't quite have the nerve to do it by yourself. And you've got to be very careful about that because trying to reinvent yourself can lead you into easier decisions rather than the tougher ones. I mean, what I think is so hard for me anyway is just being so determined and dogged. In the movie business, if you don't have a thick skin, you're just dead. You can be fired off movies all the time. I mean, it's just, and you are, everybody is. Writers are just treated like, you know, they're paid well, but they're treated very badly. So, you know, I've grown to believe that the thing that served me best has been how relentless I am. And if I had to pick one trait, I would have said years ago, I'm so lucky I have a good sense of humor or something, but now I think I'm relentless is the most important thing. Yes?
First of all, I want to thank you for saying relentless.
Yeah.
Because that works, whether you're a writer,
yeah.
Have another field that you work in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at some point, you just have to make that decision. I'm either going to back out or push it back.
Yeah, I agree.
The second one is, I really want to thank you for saying that you also reach out and help sometimes with technology.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, it's there. We all work with it. We work with it all the time. But it's not as much second nature as it is to some people. But the fact that I heard you say
I have to say that I believe in investing in yourself. I mean, when I left my marriage and took all my money, I didn't put it in the stock market or in real estate. I basically just put it in me. And I think of the same thing of hiring someone that needs to teach you something as the same thing. You know, I don't think of it as money wasted, and if anyone is telling you that, they're wrong. If it's really, really taking yourself seriously, that's what it is. Yes. Yeah. Good.
Now, so last year I turned 41. Mm-hmm. I decided that my son was 21. I was no longer responsible for him, so it was time for me to do so for me. I lost 70 pounds in last year.
Wow. That is amazing.
I reconnected with the only man I was ever in love with for 14 years. I finally told him I was in love with him, and now I'm living with him. I got a brand new job so I could move to be with him. I did all this big upheaval in my life.
This is impressive, yes.
But now I'm at the point where I just started with a friend of mine, a nonprofit organization to help women, called the Grown Ass Woman Brigade. But I'm like at that point now where I've done all this big change, and I know you've done that too. You've got all through all of these things, and now you know that there's this another thing that you want to almost stop because you're like, no, I've done all this.
Yeah.
How do you, that's kind of forward momentum that I think right now I'm trying to get to make sure I can go and do that next thing that I need to do to make this work. What's do you have any advice for somebody who's got that's already been doing it?
Right. Well, you know, there's a moment in I always think everyone can write the first 40 pages of a book, but when you get to the third quarter, it's like you're lost in the desert and you need, you know, there's no water and there's nothing and all you want to do is spend the day in the bathtub. So, you know, you're basically in the third quarter of your book and you have to get up every day and do it. I mean, one of the things that happened to me when I blocked as a writer was that I had a shrink, which will not surprise you, but anyway, I had a shrink then and he said, sit down every morning at 10 in front of it was in a typewriter, in front of your typewriter, and don't get up till 12. You don't have to write, but you cannot get up, make coffee, pet your animal, feed your plant, nothing. You have to stay in that chair till 12, and then you have to sit down again from 2 until 4. And if you do that, you will become a writer. And it's because you need work habits. Everyone needs them, whether it's writing or not, and you have to take the question, will I work, out of your day. That is not a question for your day. You will work that day. And the only way to do it is to develop those muscles. So I'm saying discipline. Discipline is not magic. It's discipline. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about discovering and then trusting your comic voice to go from crocheting to becoming the incredible comic writer you are?
Oh, God. Well, first of all, it happened in increments. You know what I mean? I didn't start writing novels till I was at least 47, 48. So, I mean, and that was a huge leap for me. And I think that if you write, certainly, and in any creative work, and maybe almost any work, you have to assume you're going to be lost in the woods. And you have to assume that your heart knows where it's going. And that is what you have to do, is trust your heart. And that assumes you're in connection with it. But, you know, I had the weirdest thing happen to me when I wrote I dreamed my book, and I didn't go down to North Carolina until I had written two drafts. And my girlfriends are yelling at me, you cannot write a book without going to where you've written about, you know. So I say, okay, so I go down there, and in my book, my lion doesn't have a tree, and Rita wants him to have a tree, and she's driving down a country road, and she sees this tree that looks like it's been struck by lightning. It's just no foliage, just the branches and the trunk, and she convinces them to dig the tree up and bring it back to the bar where Marcel is. My lion is named Marcel. Anyway, so I went down to North Carolina, and every morning I would put into the I would put into the GPS random, just take back roads, and I would pick a random destination, and I'm driving down a country road following the advice of my GPS, and there by the side of the road, in empty in a field, just as I wrote it, is the tree. And I just went, I screamed. I really just screamed. And I stopped the car, and I got out, and I'm looking at this tree, and I'm thinking, do I have to change everything I think about life now? I mean, it was just so mind-blowing. But my heart had definitely taken me there somehow or other, right? So this guy stops his pickup truck, and he says, you know, is everything okay? And I say, yes. I was with my niece, and we're just looking at this thing. And he says, well, that's his friend's tree. It's an oak tree, which was what I had said it was. And in my story, Marcel doesn't know what to do with the tree, so he just rubs himself against it. So then he says, you know, the bark's rubbed off because the goats over there come over and rub themselves against the tree. You know, and then I had this other thing where I wanted to go into a house because I wanted to know how my Clayton, who owns the bar, lived. And so I answered an ad on the wall of a Mexican restaurant. A woman was selling bread out of her home. And I went to her house, and I chatting with her, and I buy some bread. And in my story, Clayton drives, the lion doesn't drive in my book. I just want to say that. Clayton drives a 1957 Chevy Bel Air convertible. And while I'm talking to her, her husband comes home. And I walk out of the house, and there is the Chevy 1957 convertible, gorgeous, chrome polished to the max, in this totally depressed area of North Carolina. I mean, it's really a hard times. And I just think, you know, if you're talking about storytelling or whatever it is you're doing, you just have to assume that you have an inner compass. I do believe in that stuff, by the way. I really believe in it seriously. So, there. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, was this planned in detail, or was it kind of like in your head, and that's what you did?
It wasn't vague. I really don't remember if I wrote it down. I mean, since I lose everything, it wouldn't have mattered. But I know it was very concrete. In a year, you know, I have to be published. I have 2 years of money. I have to be published in places that matter. I remember trying to analyze the situation. Where would it make a difference? And what I meant by that was, what editors, if I wanted to get a book contract, where did editors read? What did they read? What didn't they read? How could my voice be heard? So I was actually, it was pretty concrete. And by the way, I have made those rules for myself. I then decided I had to learn to write an essay. You know, and it took me a year, but I figured out how to write an essay. You know, I mean, I've done things where I've set goals of things I need to accomplish, and I do them. That part of me is very, I'm disciplined that way. Yes.
Did you encourage your stepkids to follow a certain path, or was there
Are you a stepmother?
Yeah.
Then you would never ask that question because they didn't listen to anything I said. There was a moment after like 7 years where they got this little name for me. They called me Delky instead of Delia. And then that was my biggest accomplishment because I knew they loved me. I had a nickname, you know what I mean? But no, I have not, you know, I'm so fascinated by the power that my mother had because my sisters don't have that power over their children. I don't have any friends that do or I have parents, I have friends who hover over their children. But I do not have friends, I don't know anyone who is able to create this world that my mother created of sort of this idea of the Efren girls was her idea. And when I think about where she came from, that she had no money and she, you know, and she wore these very fabulous suits. And she just had, she was, I wish I knew her, because she was very cold. Really, she was cold. She had tons of theories, but she wasn't, I can't even tell you if I was ever hugged by her. I really can't. But I know that she gave me this incredible gift of, you know, she gave me a gift about confidence in the world, or that I had a destiny and that it was my own and it wasn't hooked up with a man's destiny. That it, at a time when, you know, this is the 60s, she was doing this, early 60s, it was really, and still what did I do? Still I just went and got married and took a hike. You know what I mean? But she laid that in. I've never seen any, I couldn't do it. I don't have that kind of power. And I'm a second child. I'm always seeing the other point of view. It's so depressing. You know, really. Yes. Yeah.
And this is the first year in 40 years I actually worked with somebody. Was, you know, I just turned 16. I never thought about my age. And you see a lot of comments by so many of these women that are between 60 and 65, the ones from like Cookie Roberts.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're all my friends, you know? So, absolutely, you know, I just think women have, you know, they just have a longer, you know, they have children, and then you have this whole thing where you suddenly create another world for yourself, and you have to do it. I mean, one of the things that, and my husband had to do it too, one of the things that someone once said to me is that you have three acts in your life, you know, and you, and your third act is probably going to maybe completely different from, you know, I mean, there's your childhood, and then there's your main career, and then maybe there's a third, maybe there's this third thing where you have to do it again. And you have to think of that as just as important as the other two. You have to do as much invention with that as you, whatever it's going to be, you have to really think of it. Because I know we left Los Angeles after our kids got out of high school and moved back to New York. I always wanted to be back in New York. But it started another chapter, and my husband stopped writing screenplays, and he began teaching at the film school. So, I mean, it started a whole nother chapter, and we thought, you know, we want this part to be in New York. So I do believe that you have to think of your life as an act that then, you know, what do I want this to be? Not just waiting for your children to come home, you know, and not selling the house because they're going to be so sad because they don't get to sleep in their rooms anymore. You know what I mean? Those things are powerful. They're really powerful, but you may have to make other choices. Oh, yes?
In the creative arts, I know that you're exposed to a lot of rejection.
Yes. Rejection is just, it's part of it, and I always think it's how you get tested. I mean, are you gonna go down, or are you gonna start writing the next day? Are you gonna, you know, if somebody says no to you, are you gonna go to the next person and say you're wrong? You know, I want you to, you know, do I still believe in this project, this idea, this whatever? I mean, if I believe, then I'm going to the next person and the next person and the next person, and that happens. I mean, when you write, sometimes you write something and everybody loves it, and sometimes you write it 700 times and then somebody loves it, you know? But my husband always says this thing, which I totally believe in, which is that in the end, all we have is process. We can't predict whether anyone's going to love what we do. We just can't. We can't even predict when anyone's going to sell it. So if you're not happy in the process, if you're not happy every day, if you're not sort of doing, if you're not doing it and liking it or finding a way to like it, whatever it is you're doing, then because you're so fixated on the goal of whether it will be loved by other people who you have no control over, and who may have eaten a bad fish that day and are in a really bad mood. You know what I mean? You have no control. So, I mean, process is everything in any creative art, but I think it's all you have in work, too. I mean, if your work is a grind every day, but you don't really, you're thinking, but then every 6 months, maybe this will happen, or I'll get promoted or whatever. I just think that process is all we have in life, and that it's hard to believe that, because, I mean, I've been devastated by things that haven't gone well, and I've had huge flops. I mean, Hanging Up, which was my novel, when it was developed as a movie, I hated the movie. I did. I absolutely did. That was a secret. Okay? So, I remember sitting in a screening room and just like feeling like jelly. You know, it was like I was hit by a truck or something when I saw it. And I mean, thank God I had written a book, because I had the book and I knew what I had written. But, you know, there was this thing that I thought was going to change my life. It was one of my best screenplays I'd ever written, you know, and I thought, oh my God, it's going to catapult me into some other level of God knows what I was fantasizing. But anyway, it certainly did not. And, you know, I had to do that, you know. On the other hand, there was this other weird thing that happened, which is that this book is based on my relationship with my father, who, when he became an alcoholic, became very needy. And I was the most sympathetic child, so I was the one he confided in, and really, I got very confused by what my role in the family was. It was probably the most devastating emotional relationship of my life, was how to cope with an alcoholic father who thought that he could tell me everything, you know? I mean, it was awful. So I wrote this book, and I used that as the spine of the book. It was coming to terms with his death, and it's a very funny book about three sisters and a crazy father, but it mined all of that. So one, I mean, the great thing about a writer life is that you can take something that painful and then you can make it into something else. But it was very strange, but we ended up showing that at the White House. And so I went to the White House, this awful movie that I hated, we showed it at the White House to the Clintons, which was really amazing. And I was thinking about how terrified I had been as a child in this house. And now, because of that experience, I had written a book, and now I was at the White House because of it, you know? And it's just like life. You just never know what curves it's throwing. It was totally complicated things. I didn't like the movie, but on the other hand, and then, you know, but the point is, in the end, the only thing I could count on was process. But you never know where something's leading you. You really don't. Yes. You know what? This is one I really, really didn't follow, okay? And I feel stupid that I didn't understand it. I didn't have kids, and I really wanted them to be my children, and they weren't going to be my children, and it was not a fair burden to put on them. So I felt like that's not the thing I did. I mean, we all love each other now, but I think I brought too much in. I think you have to remember their children, you know, and they are suffering through this terrible situation, which is the death of their parents' marriage, and they're trying to live with that. And so I always think the best step parents I know are the ones that are friends and keep it. You know what I mean? Don't. That's all. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. I wasn't great at it. Okay. Yes, it is available for the Dramatis Play Service. You can put it on Dramatis Play Service. It's called DPS, the Dramatis Play Service, and they will license it to you if you want to put it on. Yeah, absolutely. Well, yes. Oh my God.
Listening to your life story, as I do that, I hear that the main nine words you fell and had to start from scratch.
Yeah, I think that I knew I had to get, write the next day. I mean, that was my career. So, I mean, I had...
You were little, and I think it was very hard to tell.
Oh, oh. Right.
But I don't think you were born this way.
Maybe. You know, I'm looking back now, and part of the reason I talk about my mother rather than my father, who was actually a more emotional person, but, you know, is that I thought that she gave me a kind of strength that I ended up going back to, you know, a belief in myself and everything. And I think that that got me through, and that if I hadn't had that, I really don't know where I'd be floating around somewhere. You know, I did have a grounding of that ambition that I got very early on. And as I said, I had this very good life till I was 11. That's a lot of good years, you know, to get grounded. So I think I just was lucky. I think some of our lives are luck, you know, and maybe I just got, and I got my parents' writing gene, you know, thank God, and was able to find my way. But I, you know, that's all I can really say. Anyway, I thank you very much for listening to me and having me here. It's an honor.